This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Californians are hoping that a massive El Nino might bring rains of relief to that dreary dryness plaguing the state of California. But in August, state climatologist Michael Anderson warned West Coasters not to count on El Nino, saying that there's only a 50-50 chance of having a wetter winter. And this week, NOAA issued a new report on the possible effects of El Nino, and it has some downsides also. Here to tell us about that and other selected short subjects in science is Lauren Sommer. She's the science and environment reporter at KQED in San Francisco, where she joins us today. Welcome back to the program, Lauren.
Hi.
So California, El Nino, it's got to be there. I know when I was out there, that's what all everybody was talking about. Would it save us? What might happen if El Nino brings strong rains to California this winter?
Yeah, California is officially on El Nino watch, you know, with bated breath. What happened this week is that federal forecasters released their latest assessment of how strong it's going to be. And there's a 95% chance there's going to be a very strong El Nino in place over the winter. And that's where the warm water along the equator in the Pacific gets very warm. It can send a lot of rain California's way. Now, there are no guarantees. That's what everyone keeps saying. It's not necessarily going to hit California, but it's looking increasingly likely that the state could see some big storms this winter.
Wasn't there something called the blob out in the Pacific also that might block it?
Yeah, there's still some dynamics out there that they just can't quite predict because we've really never seen these conditions before. Warm waters, this blob of warm water sitting off the coast. You know, last winter we also saw this ridge of high pressure that was blocking all the storms.
Yeah.
But this El Nino is becoming so strong that people are starting to say, you know, it may actually be the rain buster storm that we're really hoping for.
Well, we like to hear it back east here because it knocks out some of the hurricanes that may be coming up the coast and heading into the Caribbean. Next up, how could DNA sequencing make marine conservation cheaper?
Yeah, genetic sequencing obviously has revolutionized a lot of scientific fields, but in this case, it's helping marine biologists study fish without actually getting wet. So marine biologists, you know, to do field work and to kind of assess marine ecosystems, you know, they're spending a lot of time with scuba gear, out with boats. What researchers at Stanford University are doing is they're saying they can do that with just one bottle of seawater, one water sample.
Really?
And the reason that they can do this is because of the DNA. You know, you and I, we're shedding skin cells right now as we speak. And the same is true for whales and fish and seals. They leave a lot of DNA in the water. And so they basically just take a water sample, sequence all the DNA in there, and kind of figure out what species are in the area.
So could they also be finding stuff that's flowing in from the shore that the fish are eating or, you know, getting and then discharging and DNA is floating around?
Yeah, that's the concern, right? You know, one of the first places that they tested this was in a big tank at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which makes sense, right? You kind of know what's swimming in an aquarium. Well, what they found was actually some turkey DNA, some chicken DNA, you know, things they should not necessarily be finding. It turns out that it was in the feed that the fish were getting. And so that kind of raised these issues of, well, how do you know the DNA comes from a fish or a whale or from something at 8 miles away? Or how do you know it's not drifting in on the current? So there's a lot of kind of basic science that needs to happen before this becomes a tool that marine biologists can kind of really bank on.
Good segue into basic science because the Pew Research Center tested Americans' knowledge of basic science, and this week they released the results. What did they find?
Yeah, so this was a kind of a survey of 12 basic science questions. And, you know, we're used to hearing how poorly Americans do on these types of things. This was actually some welcome news. You know, they asked questions like, you know, what's the hottest layer of the Earth? You know, the answer is the core, right? The interior. That was the question that Americans got right the most. A few questions they didn't do so well on, you know, one of them was, well, what measures how loud a sound wave is? You know, and that's the height of the wave or the amplitude. Not something that Americans knew, but obviously something every radio producer knows, of course.
Mm-hmm. If we get that wrong, we should just resign. So, and some other questions that appeared that were in between. I mean, my favorite question that they asked students years ago at Harvard graduating class, which most of them, about 90% of them got wrong, was why is it hotter in the summer than it is in the winter? You know, they thought we get closer to the sun, which is not right.
Yeah, and another one I liked on the quiz was, you know, when you're at a higher altitude, does water boil at a lower or a higher temperature? But, you know, Americans got 8 out of 12 right on this quiz. It's a kind of welcome news. It obviously, there's an overall trend, though, that we're still kind of concerned about, right? When we look at test scores for students in the U.S., you know, they're flat or below average compared to other countries that, you know, in science and math. And so there's still this overall concern about, you know, how we bring the next generation of engineers and scientists into the pipeline.
Let's get these questions into the Republican debates. What do you think? How they'd score some of these questions? No answer required. Well, yeah, it'd be kind of interesting to see what they would say. And researchers are finding something surprising in elephant seal skin.
Yeah, this is a very strange story. They were finding increased levels of mercury in the water off the California coast, this part of the central coast. And it turns out one of the main sources is from elephant seal skin. What happens is these elephant seals come to shore once a year. And while they're there, they have what's called a catastrophic molt. They lose all their hair and their fur, and it kind of decomposes, goes into the water. And that actually contains a lot of mercury because elephant seals are top predators. They're eating a lot of fish. And for top predators, the mercury bioaccumulates. It kind of concentrates the higher up the food chain that you go. And so that's where they were actually finding that this was actually going into the local water, was just from the skin.
Yeah, I guess the mercury is probably coming from coal. Coal burning has a lot of mercury in some of that coal.
Maybe. Yeah, that's one of the primary sources. It gets into the air, it gets into the water, and then you actually have microbes that take it up and kind of put it into the food system. And so, you know, there are a lot of questions. You know, nobody really knows the effects of mercury, you know, these very high mercury levels on the elephant seals themselves. You know, it's a large animal, of course. And then what's the effect on the local ecosystem? I mean, these are kind of questions that people are still teasing out because it's obviously a concern.
I like the new phrase in our vocabulary today, catastrophic molt. People will be using that for a while. Thank you, Lauren.
Thanks so much.
Nice to have you back. Lauren Sommer is science and environment reporter at KQED. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, you've seen the pictures, polar bears deprived of Arctic ice, having trouble hunting for food, searching on land now for an alternative to seal sustenance. A recent study in PLOS One finds that polar bears could get their needed nutrition from other sources. But even though the bears might be picky eaters, will it be enough to save them? Joining me now to talk about the good and bad of shifting polar bear diets is Robert Rockwell. He's one of the authors of this new paper and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. What's good about polar bears having a flexible diet?
Well, what's good about them having a flexible diet is it means that they don't have to stand on the shoreline holding a placard that says, "We're starving, please send seals." It means that they can try to eat goose eggs and geese and caribou and moose and seals that are resting on the shoreline, and even catch beluga whale calves when they're in the tidewater at low tide.
Is there enough of that there to, you know, those kinds of foods to keep them healthy?
Well, what we actually showed in this paper is that during if the ice-free period extends from 120 days to 180 days, which is what is projected over the next 25 years, then, yeah, there is enough land-based food, which would include those shoreline foods. There's enough of that there to make up the deficit. There's certainly not enough to keep them going for the whole year. For one reason, geese aren't there for the whole year. But there's enough to offset the current projected deficit.
And if the bears could survive climate change by eating other animals, so what's the bad thing?
Well, the bad thing is that climate change is causing all sorts of other problems. I mean, it's opening up the waters for exploration, for oil exploration, for mineral exploration, for increased shipping, and all those sorts of things are going to harm the bears as well. As anybody that, say, has a down sleeping bag knows, if it gets wet or if it gets oiled, in particular, it's not going to be very warm. So if you have a bear that encounters an oil spill because of increased shipping, because of less ice, then the bear's in trouble because it can't thermoregulate anymore.
Will the bears also explore the oil rigs that might be popping up?
Yeah, that's for sure. The polar bears are probably the most curious critters you're ever going to encounter. I've worked around them for 47 years, and it never ceases to amaze me what they find interesting to play with. One of the things that we've done is we have a series of Reconyx cameras set out to see who's there and what they're eating, and I have an awful lot of tonsil pictures where the polar bears come up and see the camera and decide, oh, this must be something you can chew on.
Tonsils, you get to see down their throat a little bit.
Yeah, so, a little bit.
So is there danger that they could be harmed by people who are afraid of them on the oil rigs?
Oh, sure. One of the unfortunate things is that when people see a bear coming up and they will climb up the rigs, they're not as good climbers as, say, black bears or grizzly bears, but they can get up on those rigs, is people get really terrified and they do silly things rather than just yell at them or fire some scare cartridges. Sometimes bears just get shot for being there.
And do you think that's there's a real possibility of that happening?
Oh, yeah. There's certainly a possibility. It's already happened in some cases in the Beaufort Sea, and there's been some nasty encounters all around Svalbard.
Wow. As you say, you've been studying polar bears for almost 50 years.
Correct.
What's the takeaway then when we're thinking about saving polar bears here?
I think one of the takeaways is to ask what the bears are doing. One of the things that my whole research team has been interested in is asking and observing and just trying to figure out what the bears are doing in response to it. And what they're doing is they're opportunistically foraging. I use the example that if it's lunchtime and there's a sushi bar, that's where you'll find me. But if it's lunchtime and there's no sushi bar, then pizza works. And the bears are doing that. The question is whether or not that will be enough to sustain them over the long haul, especially if climate change gets worse.
Mm-hmm. And any time man and polar bear collides, we know who's going to win.
Right. The polar bear loses, that's for sure.
All right. Robert, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
You're more than welcome.
Robert Rockwell is a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, why that beloved childhood ritual, the bedtime story, may be good for your kids. We're also going to compile a list of good reading for your kids. Reading with your kids is healthy. New research shows we'll talk about it. New kids' books, we want your suggestions. And you also can call in our number, 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever paged through the Very Hungry Caterpillar or a Good Night Moon with a child on your lap or under the covies, don't you instinctively feel that reading to kids must be good for them? I mean, that it helps their developing brains? Well, you'd be right, because research shows that when parents and kids read together, kids have bigger vocabularies, better language skills, and may find it easier to start reading on their own. So no wonder the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends making a daily dose of reading doctor's orders. In a minute, we'll be asking you, parents, kids, and librarians, to call in and share your favorite science kids books. But first, what is it? What is it about kids' books that make them such good brain builders? My next guest analyzed the text of 100 kids' books to find out. Jessa Montag talks about the science of story time. She's an assistant research psychologist, University of California, Riverside, and she's author of a study out last month in Psychological Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Your study was specific about the text of the kids' books. Why focused on the text?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you mentioned, we've known for a while that there are a lot of benefits to reading to kids in terms of vocabulary and language development and later literacy. The real question is why? You know, it could be something a lot less interesting that more affluent parents are more likely to read to their kids. So these positive outcomes we see are really just a consequence of other benefits of coming from a more affluent family. Other thoughts are it has to do with this really great one-on-one time between parents and kids that's going on during this reading. But one thing that I think has been a little less studied is the actual contribution of the text itself. So really the guiding question for this work was, what might the text of the books be providing that everyday speech is not for these children?
Mm-hmm. And you compared kids' books to conversations parents had with the kids.
Yes, that's right.
Explain a little bit for us.
Yeah, so we got the conversations from a collection of transcribed interactions between caregivers and children. These conversations were largely collected as a part of other studies, but they're now available for researchers like us who might want samples of either early childhood speech or, as we did here, early speech to children. We compared all that that sample of speech to a collection of book text that we compiled ourselves. As you mentioned, we got a list of 100 different picture books taken largely from lists of teacher and librarian recommended books, Amazon bestsellers, and circulation statistics from the local public library. And in doing this, we were able to have a nice sample of speech to kids and a nice sample of picture book text to compare to each other.
Mm-hmm. So how big was the difference between the kids' books and the regular speech? Well, what did you find?
Yeah, so what we found was when we compared our text of transcribed books to an equally sized amount of speech to kids, we found about 70% more unique words in the books than in the speech. And I should qualify that a bit, that 70% isn't going to be a magic number or anything. That's tied to the sample size we use and various methodological choices we made. So really the takeaway point is that they were clearly and substantially more unique words in the text of the picture books than in a matched sample of the speech to kids.
Huh. And did you come out of this study with a new favorite kids book for yourself?
Bark George was a really cute one about a dog who won't bark and is instead meowing and mooing, and turns out the dog had swallowed all sorts of other animals, and that's why the dog is meowing and mooing. But then at the end of the book, it turns out the dog swallowed the vet and is saying hello. That was just pretty adorable.
Well, you know, that's the great thing about kids' books is that they let you think. They let the kids think outside of the box, right? There's no penalty for that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think a real benefit of books is that it introduces new topics and new words that are generally outside the scope of a child's day-to-day life. You know, a lot of speech to kids is a lot of, you know, aren't those carrots good? Put on your shoes, things like that. But books allowed you to talk about more different things in more different contexts, even without actually being there.
Yeah, and you know, there are no right or wrong answers like there might be in school where they expect you to come up with something. You're free to think, come up with new ideas.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of, you know, really fun play with stories and with language.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice any trends in the kids' books you study?
One thing that actually popped out at me quite a bit was something that other people have pointed out as well, that in a lot of the books, the role of women is often very stereotypical, feminine, and there's a really alarming lack of representation of any people of color. Yeah, you know, and all this was a little bit beyond the scope of what we were interested in studying, but given that we know that reading to children is associated with both income and race, it seems like getting a bit more diversity in the books would ultimately be a good thing for getting books into families.
Yeah. So where do you go from here? What else would you like to study next?
So one thing that we're really interested in is looking at sentence level differences between books and text. You know, we tend to not say passives very much in our speech, but we write them quite a bit. And so this is another perhaps important benefit that the text of books is giving to children that they may not be encountering in their day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. So you would say then that the text of the book is very important when you're reading to kids. It's not just the pictures that are the important parts.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the text and the types of sentences, rarer sentences, more complex sentences, as well as, you know, rarer words that may not be, you know, something that you'd say if it weren't printed in the text.
Well, Jessica, thank you for taking time to talk with us today. Fascinating.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It was great to be here.
You're welcome. Jessica Montag is an assistant research psychologist at UC Riverside. When it comes to choosing a book to read, there's always the classics, The Cat in the Hat, The Runaway Bunny, but if you're looking for great kids' books, science-oriented kids' books, there's plenty of new classics out there to discover. And my next guests are going to help us build a list of books for the science-curious kids. I number myself among them. Let me introduce them to you. Maria Popova. Maria Popova is the editor and founder of BrainPickings.org. Maria, great to have you back on our studio.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Jacob Berkowitz is a science writer and author of the kids' book Jurassic Poop, What Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind. as well as the adult book, The Stardust Revolution, The New Story of Our Origin in the Stars. He brought together a few of his favorite science books for kids for the website Scientist's Bookshelf last year, and he joins us today from Ottawa. Welcome, Jacob.
Hi, Ira and Maria. Great to be a part of this conversation.
And I want to remind our parents and kids and school librarians out there, give us a call. Tell us about your favorite science book. Our kids' science book number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can call us up and let us know. You can also send us a tweet at SciFry if you'd rather do it that way. Let me begin by talking about the books. Maria, what's your favorite book? Have you got one you're going to pass along to us?
My favorite, I have many favorite children's science books, but I think my favorite one is called Me, Jane, which is about Jane Goodall's childhood. And it's by a British artist and writer named Patrick MacDonald. It came out in 2011. Apart from the really just purely lovely illustrations, it has the benefit of actually validating the idea that a child can dream to become something kind of kooky and then live to be that and to revolutionize that kooky field.
Yeah, we've had you on many times to talk about books, and you always bring on a kid's book or two. What are these? Is that what there is about kids' books that you like?
Well, I should mention that I don't really think, I mean, I side with J.R.R. Tolkien, who believed that there was no such thing as writing for children. And Murray Sendak, too, in his very final interview said, I don't write for children, I write. And somebody says, that's for children. And we do that. I think great children's books are great books. And in fact, I think we need to be even more discerning in what, in how much slack we cut. I remember an interview with Susan Sontag who said that 10% of what is published is actually literature, meaning 10% of books merit being called literature. And I think when we deal with a narrow field, we get a little overly excited because there are so few children's science books that we are just so excited that there is something about, say, microbiology that we don't consider what makes it great.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, you've written books for kids and adults. How would you react to this?
Well, I totally agree. When people ask me, like, what age group do I write for, I say 5 to 95. And I think a lot of people think that's just a crass marketing pitch. But I truly believe that. I mean, any good science book, you know, whether it's a parent or a grandparent who's sitting down with a young child to read the book, most people, the last time they took a science course was in high school, probably the early years of high school. And so with many of the books we're probably going to talk about today, the content is going to be new and interesting and fascinating to the 4 or 5 year old, or, you know, 7 or 8 year old, and the adult at the same time.
You know, when people ask me about Science Friday, what age do you pitch it at? I can't give them an age either. I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, right? We do stuff that everybody, hopefully, will be able to understand. We have a lot of people on the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's see if we can take a suggestion or two. Let's go to Linda in Kingston, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, one of my favorite science books to share is titled Big Bang, The Tongue-Tickling Tale of a Speck That Becomes Spectacular, by Carolyn D. Cristofano. This book, one of the things I love about it, it reads like a poem and explains the Big Bang Theory in easy-to-understand terms. In addition to the beautifully written text, the illustrations by Michael Carroll add to the reading experience. And this is a book I have shared with my family, as well as students that I have taught as a school librarian in the Silver Lake Regional School District in Kingston.
Wow,
it's always a big hit.
Sounds like a great book. Big Bang Theory in easy to understand language. Thank you. Thank you for suggesting that. Jacob, do you have a book that you'd like to suggest?
Sure. Well, let's go from the Big Bang to Animal Puke, just to mix things up a little bit. And this is a book called Get the Scoop on Animal Puke. And I, you know, really echoing what the first caller said. You know, for me, and when I'm writing for kids or adults, you know, I think the language is enormously important, as the researcher was talking about. And I think back to Dr. Seuss and, you know, his first books, and when he was going around to sell those books. Initially, publishers said, well, you know, there's no, that was the days, 1950s, it was C. Dick and Jane Run was considered, you know, pedagogically appropriate. And he was writing these very poetic, rhythmic, rhyming books. And many people said, well, this isn't going to help. This isn't going to help kids. Well, now we know that, you know, it's exactly the opposite. And, you know, so Get the Scoop on Animal Puke, I think, is really aimed at what's often called the reluctant readers, you know, often boys, age 6, 7, 8. And it uses enormously. I mean, how can you talk about, you know, animal puke? And it's amazingly across the animal kingdom. You know, it's fun. It's lots of facts. There's a kind of a mix of the gross out factor in there. But, you know, at its core, what it does is pull together all of these diverse examples of vomiting and show that, oh, there are these patterns, underlying patterns within the animal kingdom that join species. So you get this bigger evolutionary story through, you know, surprise animal puke.
Talking with Maria Popova and Jacob Berkowitz on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Coming up with a reading list for you, a book list for kids' science books. And as we're talking, we're realizing that we're all kids, right? And science books really can be read by everybody. Maria, help us build that list.
There's a lovely book called You Are Stardust by a Canadian environmental writer named Ellen Kelsley and a Korean-Canadian illustrator named Seon Kim. It is extraordinarily beautiful. All the artwork is actually three-dimensional dioramas that Kim built out of tactile materials, which were then photographed and digitally composted into the story. And the story is about how everything in our daily lives is related to ancient cosmic history, from the water in your sink that used to quench the dinosaurs to the air that comes out when you sneeze that dates back millennia. And it does a really great job in a very simple and poetic way of introducing the unfamiliar through the familiar.
Very, very interesting, because, you know, the water's been around for billions of years. Mm-hmm. It's the same water.
And the same molecules we breathe. They're Marie Curie's and Albert Einstein's. Yeah.
And Jacob, your second pick?
It's a combo, and it really riffs on what Maria was saying. This is the idea of kind of big ideas for little people. And the first book is one called Next Time You See the Moon by Emily Morgan. It's from the National Science Teachers Association. Books is the publisher. And it's from a series where it says, based on the next time you see. And for many kids, you know, they in living in cities, they're not going to see stars. But they will see every night that the moon is out, there's a good chance they'll be able to see the moon. And it's one of the major ways we get a sense of that we're actually living on a planet that's orbiting, other than day and night. And I think that it's one way parents can talk about what a child's seeing in his day-to-day life and this bigger question of planetary sciences and living on a planet. And I'll bring up the next one with the next suggestion.
All right, let me go before the break. Let's see if we can get Shirley from Howard County, Maryland, on the phone. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I adore Chameleon Chameleon by Joy Calley as a read-aloud. It's a photographic journey of a chameleon who needs to leave his tree and go to a new tree because he needs to find more food. He encounters different things in his environment. He changes colors. There's a double-page spread of his tongue coming out and catching a fly. First and second graders are all over it, and the back matter is very rich and full of different resources and the science of why the color changes, what's happening in the environment of chameleons.
Wow. And you're a librarian?
Yes, I am. I'm a librarian at Howard County Library System in Maryland.
Do kids come in looking for these books, or do you point them out to them? Kids love reading this kind of book?
Between 17 and 20% of my children's nonfiction are animal books, are science books.
Wow.
You cannot keep great animal books. And any of these photographic essays by Nick Bishop,
wow,
you know, they come in looking for that guy. You know that guy. You know, with the ones with the green cover.
Right. I want that one. They just say, I want that one with the green cover, and you know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Shelley, for taking time to be with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, talk lots more with Maria Popova and Jacob Berkowitz. And our number, 844-724-8255. As we go out, a tweet from Jen, who says, "My kids love Nature's Yucky by Woodlake Nature Center Director of Education Karen Schrag. Gross stuff, followed by easy explanations. Nature's Yucky." We hope we're not too yucky, but we like a little bit of yuck. So we'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science books for kids with Maria Popova, editor and founder of BrainPickings.org, Jacob Berkowitz, author of books for kids and adults, including Jurassic Poop, with Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind. And if you have your favorite science kids books to share, give us a call, 844-724-8255. We have a lot of people on Facebook and tweets coming in. On Facebook, Ariana Duke says, "For teenagers, Colonel Chris Hadfield's An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth is great." Yeah, he's a terrific guy, right? And Janet Cruz suggests Find the Constellation by H.A. Ray. A tweet in from Donna, who says, "Gotta go, gotta go. Sam Swope and Sue Riddle about monarch migration. I use it to teach young ones very rhythmic." And Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. Remember that
Absolutely.
One?
Absolutely.
Left a strong impression, Space Bronco says. Left a strong impression with me. Love the idea of one being to each planet. Mm. You like that book?
It's my favorite book of all time.
Is
so
that
I
right?
side with the tweeter.
What do you love so much about it?
It's an allegory of almost every immutable question of human life.
Hmm. Well, you know, The Martian, which was a book about it, now mm-hmm. made into a movie coming out, was about how it was to escape Mars. Let's see if we can go to the let me get some more picks first from both of you. Maria, what would you add next to our book list?
So I think as important as introducing kids to new words is introducing kids to new cultures and people they wouldn't encounter at home. There's a lovely book called The Amazing Discoveries of Avicenna, spelled I-B-N-S-I-N-A, who was the Persian polymath, authored 450 known works and possibly many more on math, astronomy, philosophy, poetry, and most notably medicine. He wrote the a book called the Canon of Medicine, which remained in circulation for 600 years after his death and was kind of the medieval education in medicine. But what I find really extraordinary about this book is that it comes from two Middle Eastern women, a Lebanese writer and an Iran-based Iraqi illustrator. And there's something really wonderful about how in our day, when so much of the cultural narrative about the Arab world has been hijacked by a small faction of extremists and the kind of anti-scientific beliefs under that, here's a reminder that actually so much of modern science came from the golden age of Islamic sciences, yeah. and maybe hope that we can both reclaim that and rekindle that.
Good point. Jacob, your next pick.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a riff on, you know, speaking of the Little Prince, this is a book called Buried Sunlight. It's published by Scholastic. The authors are Molly Bang and Penny Chisholm. And this gets to the kind of core of what's our relationship with our sun, our star, that we share, you know, the sun. And it's a book about climate change, but it brings it back to a very personable, very personal level. And I love the way that this book uses the concept of, you know, the sun on your face, and makes the connections between the warmth that you feel, the sun on your face, and plants, and the growth of plants turning into fossil fuels, and then mining those fossil fuels, and the effect that that has on when they're burned on heating up the planet. So again, it's one of these ways of approaching a very big idea, complex idea, global climate change, planetary science, but through the wonderful kind of entry point of just the warmth of the sun on your face.
Interesting way to introduce people to it. Let's go to the phones. Donna in Gulf Breeze, Florida. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi, Ira.
Hey there.
My mother-in-law got my daughter the book called Girls Who Looked Under Rocks, and it profiles a number of women scientists as young girls and how they got their interest in science. So it's actually changed my daughter's mind. She doesn't mind getting dirty. She doesn't mind working in the garden and digging up worms. And she does stay away from snakes, but that's my husband's doing. She still doesn't like getting her face wet in the shower, but she'll play with dirt to the, you know, the cows come home.
And so it really, as you say, really did change her life from reading a book.
Yes, because it showed her that it's not just boys who go out and look under rocks and find things interesting, because she did, and some of the boys were making fun of her. And we said, well, hold on a second. Look at these women and the contributions that they've made to our scientific discovery. Ignore the boys. Let's go dig in the garden.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing that with us. Marie, any reacting to that?
Yes, very much so. First of all, I love Mary Anning, the fossil hunter, so I hope she's one of the characters in that book, which I look forward to getting. But another book in the same vein is called Summer Birds, The Butterflies of Maria Marian, who was this amazing 17th century German naturalist and self-taught artist. She started studying insects when she was a little girl, 200 years before there was real science education for women.
Wow.
And then taught herself art and then married the two by doing the most detailed and extensive illustration of butterfly metamorphosis, which forever changed the understanding of both etymology and the natural history illustration. And all the while, she was raising her daughters. And eventually, with one of her young daughters, she traveled to South Africa at a time when women had no mobility and no agency of their own. And then she had a stroke, and she continued to paint and to study after the stroke. Just an extraordinary woman.
It's amazing. Do you think we're seeing more books that girls, or finding girls more interested?
I hope so. I'm very disheartened by a study that came out in 2011 that showed that 31% of children's books feature women protagonists. I think in the 4 years since, we're seeing more, but especially the confluence of gender equality and women in science is still such a slim portion.
We're going to have to say goodbye. That's a good point to end on. Thank you, Maria.
Thank you so much
for having
me.
Maria Popova, editor and founder of BrainPickings.org, and Jacob Berkowitz, author of books for kids and adults, including Jurassic Poop, What Dinosaurs and Others Left Behind. I think we know what that's going to be about. Thank you, Jacob.
My treat. Thank you.
For taking time to be with us today. I want to now move on to, we have a number of staff here at Science Friday who bike to work. I mean, a growing number of commuters are choosing two wheels over four, and bike commuting, believe it or not, has jumped up 60% in the last decade, according to a U.S. Census Bureau report. And you all know that biking is a great exercise, but it does come with some risks. In New York, cyclists have to be alert to tourists in the bike paths. And, the taxi door that opens that might catch you by surprise. But one hazard that's harder to see is the pollution in the air. What's it like to bike in New York City?
But it was just so much construction that on top of the pollution of the cars and the construction pollution, I just couldn't take it anymore. I would come home and I would have like black snot, and it was just nasty.
Just nasty. That's Mirna Gatica, a bike commuter here in New York, whose black snot was just part of a report and study by radio station WNYC and Columbia University. So what exactly is it in the face full of smoke that you inhale while waiting in traffic? And how might it affect your health? My next guests are working on mapping out the pollution hotspots in the city and measuring how all of this city air affects the health of cyclists. Stephen Chilrood is a research professor at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. That's at Columbia University here in New York. And Fred Mogul is the healthcare and medicine reporter at WNYC, New York's flagship public radio station. And he followed Mirna around the city. They're both here in our CUNY studios. Welcome.
Hi there.
To Science Friday. What was it like following Mirna around the city?
It was wonderful. One of the reasons she got selected to be one of the sort of inaugural members of our bicycle brigade is because Mirna has just a really interesting commute. You know, here in New York, there's sort of a dime and a dozen people who bike around Brooklyn and Manhattan. She bikes daily from the Bronx, from Queens to the Bronx and back over the Triborough Bridge, which is where she and I were talking about.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean,
that's
many.
A long trip.
Yeah. And thousands of people cross this bridge a day in their car. Very few people ever notice or think that you could do it on foot or on a bicycle. And there we were, standing up there, surveying the five boroughs, breathing in the exhaust, and talking about black snot. So it was a lot of fun.
But aren't there air monitors all over the city? Why do you have to monitor yourself? What's the difference here?
Well, so for decades, there have been monitors on rooftops. More recently, there have been ones that have moved down a little lower. They're on lamp poles. They're very sophisticated things some of those monitors can do, but they speak to what's in the air, and they do a good job. And you can do mathematical calculations, and people do, of course, about what it's like to breathe what's in the air. But we actually wanted to see what that was like at the street level for people exerting themselves, because when you cycle, your heart starts pumping, you start breathing harder. And literally, you breathe deeper, you can amplify whatever it is that's in the air and its impact on your health.
Steve, this is a long-term study. Can you describe the setup now for phase one?
Sure.
You got it started.
So this is a five-year study, and it's in two phases. And it's actually really clever of the funding agency, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences. They give us one phase to work out the feasibility of everything. You know, make sure everything's working, including recruiting the biking brigade through WNYC, and make sure that everything works. And if everything works, then we get the green light to do the health study, which is the second phase, which is the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And so you go through first monitoring how they normally breathe and what their normal air content is, and then measuring it as they're biking through the city.
Yeah, so we have them wearing air pollution monitors that measure minute by minute, but we're also measuring how much they're breathing, the volume of air they're breathing minute by minute. And it's those two things together that gives you your dose. And we think dose is a better metric, a better measure than just the concentration alone, because you can breathe 10 times higher when you're really exercising than when you're just sitting watching TV.
Do you hope that you can actually create a map of the city where the worst spots are for the air pollution?
Yeah? Yeah, I mean, I think we have that goal, and actually we have an interim goal of doing a somewhat cruder version using those rooftop monitors, which actually, you know, do a pretty decent job. There are a few different networks of stationary monitors that do a pretty decent job of mapping that out, and we're going to overlay that in somewhat sooner rather than later, just what sort of overlay that with what bikers are doing. So I think we can do that. Eventually, we would like to make it more and more granular, and we'd like to put something in people's smartphones where they can kind of use an app to generate, you know, better, cleaner routes.
If you just joined us, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about bike riding in the city with Fred Mogul and Stephen Childrude. Do we know, is there any research out about the effects, about what people are sucking in as bike riders?
Sure. I mean, there's been lots of health studies saying that air pollution has negative health impacts, but it's usually looking at the chronic exposure over years. And there's also been research looking at daily exposure. Here we're kind of cutting it down to very short-term doses, you know, kind of this hourly exposure and looking for those health effects. And that's less well-known.
Because when you heard Myrna say that she has black snot when she gets done, this does obviously is not something unusual than for bike riders.
No.
But we don't know what the effects, the long-term effects of that might be on her or other.
Well, this study is looking at what the short-term indicators are that might lead to long-term effects. So is there a short-term impact to your heart, to your blood pressure, or to your heart rate variability?
Mm-hmm. And Fred, what do you hope to come out with from this study?
I think we believe that there's an overwhelming body of evidence that that strongly indicates exercise is good, right? That you didn't need to invite me here to tell your listeners about that. I think there's a net positive of cycling and of exercise, and overall, within certain parameters, the more you do, it's better. But there's benefits and there are risks. If we could quantify those risks and think about ways to diminish those risks, I think that would make the net benefit that much stronger.
Mm-hmm. Are you still looking for volunteers for this study? Are you
Sure.
enough people? Or?
Well, we have these different phases and these different ways we're going to interact with the biking brigade. Mm-hmm. And there's this very active phase where in phase one we're just dealing with several dozens of people. But there are these other activities that are coming up where we're really hoping to have the hundreds to participate. So there, the more the better. So we're still looking for more volunteers.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like, in phase one of a drug trial, you use a small
right.
group and then you get bigger. Right now, we're just kind of fine-tuning the methodology and the measurement potential, the technology. We have these very multi-thousand-dollar air monitors. We can really only put them on a few people at a time. As the technology gets cheaper, we can deploy more people, perhaps with cheaper sensors
yeah.
if they're more or less up to the task. So we're going to get more people involved that way, and we're going to do sort of ancillary projects as well.
Was Myrna typical of other bike riders? I mean, do they worry? Are they worried about this as they go through town?
I mean, I think the cycling community is a very passionate one.
Right.
Particularly the people, the more you do it, the more passionate you are. We'd like to think probably the more thoughtful, but I think many people, it's kind of on their list. I think people are very focused on potholes and on traffic and on obstructed bike pathways, which is in one of these ancillary projects we're going
right.
to hopefully get people involved in. And I think maybe they weren't necessarily focused. All the way Myrna was on what's in the air. But I think certainly I've heard about black snot from other people as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to stay up to date with the study, you can go to the website that they have out there at wnyc.org/streets. And you can watch a video that we produced there. Also, I want to thank Steve Chilrood and Fred Mogul, the healthcare and medicine reporter at New York Public Radio's WNYC. Thank you. And good luck on your study.
Thanks so much.
One last thing. Let's not forget that 14 years after 9/11, 70,000 patients are still being monitored and treated for mental health care problems, digestive disorders, and cancers. And a number of the people being treated grows each year. And as reported by The Atlantic, the World Trade Center Health Program is set to expire next month, and the Victim Compensation Fund is set to expire in 2016, unless Congress decides to refund it. Besides ending treatments, the loss of funding would discontinue research as well, just as scientists are on the verge of finding a definitive empirical link between the incident and the illnesses. So while Congress fiddles over the money, the real bulk of 9/11-related cancer deaths is probably yet to come. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. SciArts producer Annie Minhoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Production assistant Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Reminder, there's a complete list of the books we mentioned this hour. It's on our website where you can share your book suggestions, sciencefriday.com/kidsread. And while you're there, you can also join our mailing list. And if you like us, go to our Facebook. Yeah, like us on Facebook. We tweet all week at SciFry. We've got iPhone and Android apps. You can take us along and listen and watch the videos anytime you'd like. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.